From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. When most of us hear the term ham radio, we probably think of hobbyists with big radio sets that dominate their desks and their dens, or maybe we think of truckers driving down I-5. But as you'll learn today on the show, there's so much more than that. In the event of a major earthquake or disaster, our cell phones and landlines may become useless. Only line-of-sight radios would work and would become a vital link between communities and first responders. Today, you'll hear from two leaders of Lane County's Amateur Radio Emergency Service and hear about the vital role they'll play in the event of a big disaster. Then, at the end of the show, we check in with a local teacher trying to break the record for fastest bike travel from Canada to Mexico. That's next on Oregon on the Record. In our hyper-connected world, we've all come to rely on our smartphones for pretty much all of our communications. But what if that backbone of those phones was destroyed in an earthquake? Today on the show, we'll learn more about amateur radio and the vital link it and the people behind it will play in our community's recovery from the big one. Catherine Catherwood and Jeff Hall, they are leaders of the Amateur Radio Emergency Service for Lane and West Lane County, respectively. Thanks to you both for coming in and chatting with us.
Thank you for having
us. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Boy, I'm going to start, Catherine, just with you. Tell folks, what is an Amateur Radio Emergency Service? What does it do?
It's called ARES, Amateur Radio Emergency Services, and it's a community of volunteer ham radio operators who provide their skills and their equipment to help the community in case of an emergency.
Okay. And Jeff, you know, maybe talk about why that's important. Catherine just explained what it is. Why is it? Why is it important to have ARES in our community?
So ARES, which Catherine mentioned, is a specialized group of ham operators, ham radio, another term for amateur radio. Mm-hmm. It's an independent infrastructure separate from cell towers or internet. So in most cases, ARES members operate completely off-grid with batteries and solar power. So we can... We can use different frequencies for short and long distance communications, and so we can operate when all other systems have failed or are down.
Okay. Catherine, talk about, you and I were off mic talking about the idea of building community. Tell the listeners about that, about why it's important for ham radios, amateur radio operators to form that kind of community, and what it can become on our worst day when an emergency, a community-wide emergency were to occur.
On that really bad day, the people that you're going to be able to count on most are your neighbors, your community. So by working together to get to know each other, to have that familiarity, to build those bonds that are necessary to have when you're communicating, that's the community that we're putting together right now.
Okay. Jeff, I think I read some literature saying that Oregon has a really high population of amateur radio operators. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that it's a big thing here in Oregon?
It is, and I didn't know those facts until Scott, our state Amateur Radio and Relay League president, had mentioned the numbers, but he quoted 20,000 ham operators in Oregon, and I kind of agree with his sentiment that because we have so many rural areas, which really lends itself to amateur radio communication, is one reason, and it's just a fun hobby. So I think our combination of retirees and remote areas leads itself to people want to be involved with an amateur radio.
Yeah. Catherine, talk about this both from a perspective of a hobby, like Jeff just mentioned, but also the importance of it. How do you sort of balance but those two things, to have fun, but also realize you and your colleagues might become an absolutely critical part of recovery after a disaster?
We do have weekly nets where we practice our skills to improve as ham radio operators for passing message traffic, which is what we would be doing in case of an emergency. But we also, once a month or so, we try to get out and do an activity. Parks on the Air is a fun activity to get out into our state and national parks and activate as a ham radio operator, communicate with each other. It gives you the practice of going off grid, going out of the house, and doing something fun with your equipment. There are also activities like we build antennas. Hmm. We learn the skills that we'll need if we have to cobble together a station out of bits and pieces of what's available. So that besides the fun of doing the activity, there are so many different things you can do with amateur radio. It's not all about the emergency communication, but by putting it all together, it improves your skill as an operator.
Yeah. Jeff, talk a little bit more about that, about improving your skill as an operator. I mean, can anybody do it? Does anybody need any sort of baseline skills before they become a ham radio, before they want to enter the certification to become a ham radio operator? What does it take to begin?
Well, there's ham operators of all ages here in the Florence area, West Lane County. We have a couple new members who are in high school that have studied and passed the test, and then all ages and nationalities, and it does focus a lot on the electronic technical focus of it, but it's not super easy. I mean, you don't have to understand calculus or anything to pass the test, but it does do some basic functions. One of the core tenets of electronics is Ohm law, where you can calculate power and amperage and resistance and impedance using very basic functions and math skills. So that's a large portion of the test. But like I said, that it doesn't really matter. You know, your age or technical ability, there's many options for learning the skills to pass the different level of tests involved for ham radio.
Okay. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Catherine Wood and Jeff Hall. They are amateur radio emergency service leaders in Lane County and West Lane County. Catherine, I'm going to go to you in terms of there are different types of designations to use radios. Can you talk a little bit about the differences?
Absolutely. Everybody's usually familiar with walkie-talkies.
That's indeed
called Family Radio Service, or FRS.
Okay.
Doesn't require a license. That's kind of the first step into the world of radio. There's also a General Mobile Radio System, GMRS radios, which requires a $35 license from the FCC, no test involved, and the license covers your entire family for a 10-year period. So that you just get the radio, and there are various groups that you can work with. Amateur radio, there are tests that you have to pass, but I always tell people the test is just sort of like getting your learner's permit.
Hmm.
You study, you pass the exam. There are wonderful online services that you can use to practice to get ready for those exams. But then once you get your radio, that's when you really start learning. There's a group locally here in the Eugene Springfield area called the Now What Net that meets once a month for hands-on practice with, okay, I've got the license, I've got the radio, now what? And we start with, this is how you turn it on, this is how you charge the battery, really teach people the basics. And then from there are just so many different directions you can go. So there are different ways to get into radio, and every one of them is valuable.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff, like you said before, you're out there on the coast in Florence. Talk a little bit about how West Lane and Lane County, how you work together, whether it's training, having the fun you talked about, but also how you'd work together in a community-wide emergency.
Well, We use our skills and communication equipment. Like I mentioned, we have different frequencies that are appropriate for short and long distance communication. So out here on the coast, where we're could be isolated in a disaster. You know, we've got a major artery, the 101 highway that, mm-hmm. that comes over the Siusla River. You know, if an earthquake or a flood were to happen and it would damage that bridge, we would be quite a bit isolated out here. And so the need for communicating to the main emergency office coordination in the Eugene area to let them know what type of need we need, whether it be medical supplies or medical expertise or just food and water. So being on the coast here and being susceptible to disasters and being isolated, ham radio could play a big part in letting the county and state level agencies know what resources we may need.
Yeah. Catherine, maybe if you could sort of a little bit of a tabletop expert exercise, I should say, if let's say an earthquake were to happen, what would your organization, how would you mobilize and what would be the steps that the ARES program that you lead here for Lane County, how would it jump into action?
So the first thing that I tell all the folks to do is first make sure that you and your family are safe and secure. Mm-hmm. You can't volunteer until you know that your family is taken care of.
Yep.
But the first thing beyond that you would do is get on the radio and listen, see who's out there, what's going on. All of our people know what frequency they need to report to, and it depends what agency they're working with as to which frequency they would go to. And then my group would be activated by the county emergency management. So I would get word from Lane County that we were activated and what their need is, and then I would go on the air and tell the people where they needed to go and what their positions would be required to do.
Okay. Jeff, you talked a little bit about having some members for your group who are in high school. Are you growing membership? Are more younger people joining the ham radio and amateur radio community?
Well, sure. Hope so. We're trying to develop a program with our local high school. Scouting is kind of in the decline in this area, but we hope to regroup with the scouting organizations, and we have a lot of community outreach. Typically mobilize out into the field and set up our equipment and make contacts locally and across the country and across the world. It's kind of a contest, but it's also just a great way to test our equipment and to connect with other ham operators. So we advertise locally that this is a kid-friendly event, and so we set up activities to show people our equipment, and we actually have a station referred to as GOTA, Get on the Air, where we can supervise and monitor the general public that aren't licensed with our monitoring teaching. We can get them on the air and make these contacts themselves. So that's one way where we're getting not just the younger crowd, but the general public hopefully interested in amateur radio.
Okay. Catherine, you know, Jeff just mentioned a key word there, global. Talk about the fact that this isn't just, you know, within a narrow range of a few miles. It is kind of a global community, isn't it?
Absolutely. There are a lot of folks who make contacts on high-frequency radio. They talk to South America. It's very easy to hit Japan from here. You just point your antenna west and you have Japan. But also Europe as well. So it's a great way to just reach out. And we all have something in common. I talked with a group of hams just recently, and they were amazed when I asked them, what do you do that's not amateur radio? And they saw each other's backgrounds and how diverse we are, but we all do radio together.
Yeah. Jeff, what about you? I mean, talk about the community that you're building there out on the coast, but also, you know, the opportunity to speak to people in different countries.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun involved with that. Reaching out to people in different countries and using our equipment, and when we're doing those contacts, it's basically very informal, and sometimes we get into nice long conversations about the weather, and almost always we talk about our equipment and the time in the hobby, how long we've been practicing and on the air, so to speak. So it's a fun global community that's involved with amateur radio.
Okay. Catherine, last question is to you. If someone were listening right now and thought, boy, this sounds like fun, this sounds like something I'd like to be a part of, what should they do?
Well, if they're in the Eugene Springfield area, I would say start by going to one of the club meetings. Mm-hmm. Valley Radio Club meets on the first Friday of each month at Norkenzie Christian Church on Crescent Avenue. Mm-hmm. Springfield Radio Club meets the second Tuesday of each month over at the Springfield Justice Center. Or if they want some personal information, I'd be happy to answer an email. ki7rnu@gmail.com.
I'll put that link on our web post. Well, this has been great. We've been talking with Catherine Catherwood, and we've been talking with Jeff Hall. They're amateur radio emergency service leaders in Lane and West Lane County. Thanks to you both for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
It sure has. Thank you, Michael.
Now let's check in on a local middle school teacher who's spending his summer trying to become the fastest biker from Canada to Mexico. Tanner Ferris, a middle school math teacher here in Eugene and a marathon cyclist. Tanner, how the heck are you?
I am sore, but I am happy to be in sunny Los Angeles, Michael.
So the last time you and I spoke, you were getting ready for this monster adventure to be the fastest known time bicycling from Canada to Mexico. How have things been going?
I put in 6 solid months of getting ready. I had an awesome plan to cut the old record down. Old record was 9.5 days, and I knew I could do it in about 9. And about 3 weeks before I left, the guy got a hold of me and said, hey, I'm going to give this a shot. He did it in 6.5 days.
Wow. Okay.
So I had to set my bar even higher, and I really wanted to give it a go. I hadn't trained specifically for riding through the night. I kind of avoided that, as I'm a little bit of a zombie if I'm not getting the sleep. And so I set some waypoints I'd have to hit, some benchmarks I need to make for me to be able to get this new record. I'm going to come up a little bit short here, but I'm really proud of myself for look like I'm going to finish in about 7.5 days, so 2 days off that old record.
Wow, that's amazing. Congratulations for that. So, boy, just for folks who can't even imagine doing what you've done, you know, what were some of the high points and what were some of the low points?
Yeah, for sure. Getting to do the entire state of Washington in one day was amazing. Taking that ferry across the channel there, riding around 101 in places I haven't seen before. And then I love the Oregon coast. That's home. And so I cooked through that in a couple of days and just felt so familiar. Some of the low points, getting trapped out on the side of the road as I was pushing to make these hotels. I have been getting in at about 3 or 4 in the morning. And as I was saying, as far as being a zombie when I'm sleepy, I've had to take some micro naps on the side of the road or else I start hallucinating, which isn't too fun.
I imagine not. What was it like through California? Obviously, that presents a whole nother set of challenges, especially, you know, hills and heat and whatnot.
Yeah, the Northern California coast, I was not ready for how much it only went up and down. So to cross the creeks there, they don't have the crossings on high bridges like they do through Big Sur, so you have to drop all the way down into a gulch and then climb up an equally steep hill on the backside, and you do that about 100 times. I measure my climbing in Fox Hollows, and I probably did at least 100 Fox Hollows on the north of California coast there.
Wow. You know, other than trying to break the record, remind folks, when we talked last, of some of your other motivations for trying to break this record and for going on this epic journey.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it goes back to what I do as a teacher, and I ask kids to do really difficult things every day, and I want to let them know that there's always a little bit more to give, even when they feel like they've reached their capacity. I've had to keep telling myself that, practice what I preach as I'm trying to nap on the side of the road, just pushing through to get through the hotel and get the 250 miles out that I've planned each day. And so I've been able to do it, and I felt really good about it, and I know that I can bring those lessons back to the classroom.
Well, I think it's going to be a lot of fun when you, as most teachers do, when you get back there in September, and maybe you ask your class, you know, what did you do this summer? And you're going to have a great tale to tell them. But I'm also, you know, you also, if I remember correctly, you were raising some money and also just raising awareness for, you know, how amazing a human being can be when they set their mind to something.
Yeah, certainly. I just the goal setting piece of it has been huge for me, and just to let people know that you just stretch yourself beyond what you think is possible, and that's what I've done for this attempt. Is, you know, I 9 days I knew I could do, but 6.5 days it's like, well, I'm going to give it my best shot, and it just pushed me further than I've ever gone before to do something amazing.
So once you finish, do you think maybe in a few weeks or even a few months, you'll think, oh, I'm going to try it again? Or was this enough to do what your initial goal was, to beat that 9 days?
You know, 48 hours of no sleep, and I had wanted nothing to do with this again. But now as I'm getting close to the finish and know that if I tighten up the logistics a little bit, I think I can really make a go at that 6.5 days. So I'll have to take a couple weeks, let the body heal, let the mind heal a little bit. I'm going to be really happy to be off the bike here at the end of the night.
I was just going to say, yeah, take us through maybe the first few days after you're done. What do you want to do?
I just want to eat and sleep and see my kids. So my partner MJ is going to be flying out. They're actually here. I'm just arrived in San Diego this morning, and it's going to meet me down right at the border crossing in Tijuana, and just amazing to think that we're going to be hugging each other in just a little bit, and still got all of Orange County to go, so a lot of great road to see still.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you do. Yeah, and Orange County, for folks who may not know, that's huge. You've still got a ways to go, but you know, it's really inspiring what you've been doing, and it's great that you've been safe. And gosh, you know, it's been great to check in on you, and be safe. Thanks again so much for checking in on from the road.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You take care.
Take care. Bye bye. That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, we check in with eWeb as it prepares for the hottest part of summer and also has tips on how we can stay cooler. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.